Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. An international tribunal in The Hague Tuesday rejected China's claim of sovereignty over most of the South China Sea and ruled it violated the maritime rights of the Philippines. The long-anticipated landmark ruling resulted in a sharp response from Beijing, which refused to take part and warned it would not recognize. China's ambassador to Washington, Sui Tian Kai, said and warned that the ruling will disincentivize negotiation and intensify conflict.
The proceedings will probably do a great deal of damage to the efforts by the members of the international community to engage in negotiations and consultation for settlement of any possible disputes.
But he said Beijing remains committed to negotiation with other parties over the matter. In Manila, Philippine Foreign Secretary Perfecto Yasay called it a milestone ruling.
We call on those concerned to exercise restraint and sobriety. The Philippines strongly affirms its respect for this milestone decision.
And President Rodrigo Duterte called for bilateral negotiations to resolve the matter. Tuesday's ruling addressed a complaint brought by Manila 3 years ago accusing Beijing of violating the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas with its actions on the Scarborough Shoal, a reef located off the Philippine coast. The UN has warned of severe acute malnutrition and famine-like conditions across Nigeria's northeastern Borno state, affecting displacement camps, housing tens of thousands of refugees who fled Boko Haram violence. The camps described as hard to reach and insecure. An appeal has been issued for more than $200 million in funds over the next 10 weeks. This is VOA News. The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson, said Tuesday that President Obama has given him greater freedom to strike out at the Taliban under new rules of engagement announced during a visit by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter.
Previously, General Nicholson's authorities were that when or if Afghan security forces found themselves in a difficult situation, then they could call their American counterparts and their American counterparts could come and go shoulder to shoulder with them and help. It obviously, to me, makes a lot more sense to be doing it the way we're doing it now.
U.S. troops will be able to accompany and enable their Afghan counterparts confronting Taliban threats through the use of engineers, electronic warfare specialists, and allow for greater use of U.S. air power. Last week, President Obama announced he was slowing the withdrawal rate of U.S. troops. Instead of drawing down to 5,500 troops by year's end, 8,400 will remain in Afghanistan through his presidency in January. A fragile ceasefire called by rebel leaders held tentatively Tuesday in South Sudan's capital, Juba. After 5 days of artillery and small arms fire that left hundreds dead and displaced tens of thousands. The truce called Monday by both President Salva Kiir and his longtime rival, First Vice President Riek Machar, after forces loyal to both used anti-aircraft guns, attack helicopters and tanks against each other. Michael Makwe is the country's information minister.
All the commanders of these forces are hereby directed to cease any hostility and abide by this order, control their forces, and protect the civil population and their property.
The violence raised fears the country, just 5 years old, was slipping back into civil war. President Obama Tuesday took part in an interfaith service to honor five policemen killed last week in Dallas, Texas, by a lone sniper.
We're here to honor the memory and mourn the loss of five fellow Americans, to grieve with their loved ones, to support this community, to pray for the wounded, and to try and find some meaning amidst our sorrow.
The attack was carried out by a slain Black Army veteran who claimed he was out to kill white people following the police killings of two Black men in Louisiana and Minnesota. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called an emergency cabinet meeting Tuesday over recent violence in Kashmir, sparked by a killing of a Muslim rebel leader last week. Nearly 30 have been killed, hundreds wounded. Peace talks in Tanzania to resolve Burundi's political dispute stalled, with both sides electing not to take part. Members of the opposition oppose the presence of Burundians accused of human rights abuses, while the government rejects the presence of leading opposition and civil society figures. Asian markets continue to rally this week as prospects for solid U.S. economic growth continue. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe authorities arrest a popular anti-government protest leader.
No matter how much you arrest Mawarire, issues, they remain the same. Number one, the government must fire corrupt ministers. Number two, pay the civil servants on time. Number three, police brutality must absolutely stop in Zimbabwe.
That's Pastor Evan Mawari shortly before he was taken into police custody. Residents of South Sudan's capital returned to their looted properties as a ceasefire appears to be holding. 1 billion children are victims of physical and sexual violence, and Ugandan opposition leader released on bail remains defiant.
I think that this is what the government fears. It fears that his continued popularity undermines their legitimacy and also reminds Ugandans and the world that the elections we had in February were not free or fair.
George Kanyihamba is a former justice of the Ugandan Supreme Court. The UN says new HIV infections are on the rise in some regions of the world, and new police shootings put spotlight back on police procedures and training in the United States. Those stories plus Mark Omar, plus remembering our sports reporter Mark Omar, who died suddenly this week. Police in Zimbabwe have arrested a pastor after he posted several messages on social media calling on people to protest police brutality and some of the government's economic measures. Sebastian Mofu has more for VOA from Harare.
The arrest of Ivan Mawarire on Tuesday took place ahead of a planned two-day protest which the clergyman has been promoting with the hashtag #ShutDownZimbabwe. Mawarire is increasingly known in the country as this flag pastor because of his popular this flag Twitter hashtag and of always moving around with a Zimbabwean flag around his neck. His campaign is supported by a group calling itself Tajamuka Sijikile Shona Ndebele for We Have Revolted, respectively. The group is also calling on Zimbabweans to embark on the strike beginning on Wednesday. In an interview, Harrison Nkomo from Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights said Mawarire has been charged with inciting violence and disturbing the peace based on videos he has been posting on social media. Nkomo said on Tuesday the police searched Mawarire's home and church building.
The searches were conducted in terms of a search warrant which was issued by a magistrate. They are looking for subversive material. And I'm glad to announce that after the search of the church and his premises, nothing of that sort was found.
Recently, Zimbabwe has seen a series of anti-Mugabe demonstrations rarely witnessed during the president's 36-year rule. Ahead of his arrest, Mawarire posted to social media a video in which he said his detention must not deter Zimbabweans from taking part in the demonstrations.
No matter how much you arrest Mawarire, issues, they remain the same. And what we shall continue to do that is to break fear. So the issues remain the same. Number one, the government must fire corrupt ministers. Number two, pay the civil servants on time. Number three, police brutality. That one must absolutely stop in Zimbabwe. Number four, we are saying no, we don't want bond notes in Zimbabwe. And number five, we are saying no to the import ban on basic commodities.
The demonstrations began late last month on Zimbabwe's border with South Africa after Harare imposed restrictions on the importations of basic commodities. Since then, protests have taken place in other areas, including Harare and the second biggest city, Bulawayo. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights says it has represented more than 300 citizens who marched in the protest. On Tuesday, the rights group said it was bracing for more arrests ahead of the rallies this week. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye, who was released from prison yesterday on bail, has urged his supporters not to give up their fight for a better Uganda. According to the Ugandan Monitor, Dr. Besigye told his supporters that they are fighting to reclaim their country and that until that is achieved, there is no turning back. Besigye, who came second in last February's presidential election, was arrested and charged with treason after he declared himself president. The judge warned him at his release to refrain from violence and to work to preserve peace in the community. George Kanyihamba, former justice of the Ugandan Supreme Court, says the Ugandan government fears Dr. Besigye because of his popularity.
Most Ugandans believe that the reason he's been chased and arrested and indicted for non-existing offenses is not so much that they fear any breakdown of law and order or insecurity, but because of his popularity. I think that this is really what the government fears. It fears that his continued popularity undermines their legitimacy and also reminds Ugandans and the world that the elections we had in February were not free or fair.
Justice, what do you make of the fact that the judge has told Dr. Besigye to refrain from acts of violence and to preserve peace in the community until his case is disposed of? Isn't this a restriction on him?
When you are charged with a serious offense in the courts, then the judge is empowered to set conditions of your appeal. And one of those conditions is that you should not continue committing offenses in charge. But then Ugandans, when they read those terms, they are baffled because the restriction is to stop him carrying out what they call defiance. Defiance is not an offense under our law. But if defiance means that I will not obey your unlawful orders, I will not respect when you violate the Constitution, then they are prohibiting them from doing what the Constitution allows them to do, namely the right to demonstrate, the right to march against unlawful orders and the brutality of the police. In effect, they are criminalizing activities which are constitutional and legitimate under our law.
The attorney has objected to the bill application, first suggesting that Dr. Besigye had failed to provide documented evidence, such as his birth certificate, to indicate his real age. What does that have to do with the case?
Nothing to do with the case at all. It's not only Dr. Besigye whose age people are not happy about. President Museveni himself, in his own writing, says he doesn't know when he was born. Many Ugandans, in particular of all the age, some of them were never registered anyway. They don't know their age. It's not an offense not to know your age. It's just ridiculous.
So what do you expect, Justice? What is going to become of this case? Is it eventually going to be dismissed? And in light of the bill, do you now have confidence in the judicial system?
I don't have confidence in the judicial system. I am almost a one-man campaign who says that the judiciary has been compromised, that the judiciary today in Uganda has been corrupted, that many judicial officers, including judges, even the president himself, President Museveni, has said they are corrupt. So if you have a judiciary which is corrupt, where many judicial officers work for bribes and compromises, you cannot see people of justice. We have a political scenario unrelated to the Constitution, the law. So really, as I'm saying, government is fighting very hard to maintain some kind of legitimacy in its governance of the country. And this has become a symbol of all opposition against injustice and oppression in the country.
George Kanyihamba is a former justice of the Ugandan Supreme Court. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Today's Wednesday, July 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's send a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda, Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya, and Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Residents of South Sudan's capital returned to the streets on Tuesday as a ceasefire to end 5 days of deadly clashes appeared to take hold. But visitors to the city's central market were met by the sight of looted stores and sharply hiked prices for suddenly scarce goods. Presidential spokesman Wek Aten told reporters in Juba on Tuesday that the ceasefire is holding and that the airport is reopened.
It is good news that it is holding, because this morning there has not been any gunshot anywhere. You people can attest to that. Now it is time for you people to be going out to witness the cessation of hostilities that is holding. And it will be you people to tell the world that, peace is holding in South Sudan. The international airport has opened for commercial flights, and it is now easy for anyone traveling via and from, to and from Juba to do so.
That was South Sudan presidential spokesman Aten Wek Aten. Meanwhile, traders in Juba are asking for immediate help from their government after they say their shops were looted by some errant members of the South Sudan army during the violence. Aziz Francis says everything in his shop was stolen during the 3 days of fighting in Juba.
Whether you are South Sudanese or you are a foreigner, they don't segregate. And if you take the distance of the place where the fighting is occurring, is far from our shops. But the people who are deployed here destroyed everything. They looted, they sought the locks at the doors, they sought using guns, and as a result, they picked everything. I have a wife with the 3 kids, and now I don't know how will I help my kids. It is that business which helps me with my family and with my kids. So I'm appealing to the government. If there should be any help or assistance, they have to also do that for us.
Aziz Francis is a trader in South Sudan's capital, Juba. The World Health Organization says nearly 1 billion children, almost half of the world's child population, has been victims of physical, sexual, or psychological violence over the past year. The WHO says it's launching a package of measures that it says can dramatically reduce violence against children. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Research studies estimate 1 in 4 children suffers physical abuse, and nearly 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 13 men and boys are victims of sexual abuse. Alexander Bouchard is World Health Organization coordinator for prevention of violence. He says the consequences of this kind of violence are vast but unappreciated.
What we get to see is the tip of the iceberg in the shape of death. For instance, homicide is among the top 5 causes of death in adolescents, and in some regions or in some countries is number 1 or number 2. Violence against children can cause injuries like brain injuries, internal injuries, burns, lacerations, etc., in hundreds of millions of cases. Violence against kids often can lead to mental health problems like depression and anxiety.
Bouchard says violence against children also can lead to alcohol and drug abuse, smoking, and unsafe sex. He says such dangerous behavior puts children at greater risk later in life of developing stroke, cancer, diabetes, liver disease, HIV/AIDS, and other illnesses. The good news, he says, is much of this violence against children can be prevented through measures that address the underlying causes. He says WHO and 9 partners have devised a package of 7 strategies called INSPIRE, in which each letter stands for one of the strategies. He says all have been tested and have shown concrete results. For example, he says I stands for implementation and enforcement of laws, such as limiting access by young people to firearms and other weapons. He says this has shown good results in South Africa, which has succeeded in reducing thousands of deaths, many among young people, over a 5-year period. Other measures include that of changing beliefs and behaviors around gender roles, creating safe environments, parent and caregiver support, strengthening incomes, providing treatment programs for juvenile offenders, and establishing a safe school environment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations says progress in reducing new HIV infections in adults has stalled and is on the rise in some regions of the world. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA, the report is being launched in Geneva before next week's International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa.
UNAIDS calls an upward trend in new HIV infections alarming. It notes globally these infections among adults and children have been reduced by 40% since the peak of 3 million in 1997. It says significant progress in stopping new cases among children is continuing, with a drop of more than 70% since 2001. But UNAIDS finds the decline in new cases among adults has stalled since 2010 and remains steady at an estimated 1.9 million for 5 years. UNAIDS Executive Director Michel Sidibe says the world must act urgently to scale up prevention efforts.
We have a 5-year window of opportunity. If we miss this next 5 years, we will have a rebound in this epidemic, we'll have resistance, and we'll not be able to control the epidemic and make sure that we end it by 2030.
The report finds Eastern Europe and Central Asia have seen a 57% increase annually in new HIV infections between 2010 and 2015. It says the epidemic is mainly concentrated among people who inject drugs. It says more than 80% of the region's new HIV infections in 2015 were in Russia. While these numbers are dramatic, the UNAIDS Chief of Prevention, Carl Dene, tells VOA most of the new cases are in sub-Saharan Africa.
About half of all infections are in Eastern and Southern Africa alone. So even if there is a small decline there, that doesn't mean that we have already won the battle. We need to do much more there. So even if in Eastern Europe the epidemic goes up, that doesn't mean we can be complacent with Eastern and Southern Africa.
The report says young women in sub-Saharan Africa are particularly at risk of HIV/AIDS, with 75% of new infections among adolescent girls between the ages of 10 and 19. Other vulnerable groups, it says, include gay men and other men who have sex with men, sex workers and their clients, transgender people, injecting drug users, and prisoners. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There's an urgent and dangerous debate occurring here in the United States centered around the idea that black lives have less value than white lives. As we find out from viewers Carol Pearson, public health experts say that based on the limited statistics available, that just may be the case. In order for the killings to stop, gun violence has to be treated and studied like any other public health issue.
From San Francisco to Chicago to Atlanta, protesters took to the streets calling for justice for two black men killed by police, one in Louisiana, the other in Michigan. At a protest in Minnesota, some lobbed firecrackers at police. 21 officers were injured. Meanwhile, at a memorial service in Dallas, where 5 officers were ambushed and slain, the president addressed a nation shaken by racial tensions and killings.
I'm here to insist that we are not as divided as we seem.
A movement in the African American community, Black Lives Matter, is a result of high-profile killings of black men and teenagers, most at the hands of the police. And it's not just a perception. A study at Harvard University compared deaths caused by police for black men and white men starting at age 15. Professor Nancy Krieger spoke via Skype.
Black men compared to white men were anywhere from 5 to 19 times at greater risk of a death that was classified as a law enforcement related death.
Krieger calls the difference absolutely gigantic, which she says means some of these deaths are preventable. The study calls for treating deaths at the hands of police as a public health issue.
It has major repercussions for public health in terms of obviously mortality, in terms of trauma, in terms of the impact on the families and communities involved.
The partner of Alton Sterling, killed by police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, made that point at an emotional press conference after his death.
The individuals involved in his murder took away a man with children who depended upon their daddy on a daily basis.
In order to take a public health approach, these deaths would have to be recorded and evaluated. Right now, they're not. No federal public health agency, not the Centers for Disease Control, not the National Institutes of Health, not the Office of the Surgeon General, keeps this information. Just as importantly, they aren't funded to study them.
We're at a point where we lack even basic descriptive data in this country, and that is not acceptable.
Krieger's study calls first for shooting deaths caused by police to be added to official databases so they can then be studied and the killings stopped. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This morning, we are remembering Monk Ouman, our Daybreak Africa sportscaster, who passed away suddenly this week. Ray Ondoro of Nairobi, Kenya writes, "Please receive my sincere condolences for the loss of your colleague and a great sports reporter, Monk Ouma, my countryman. I am a regular listener of Daybreak Africa for many years, and I've always enjoyed the late Mr. Ouma's detailed reports on sporting activities from all over Mother Africa. In fact, listening to his last report last Saturday, I felt that something was very wrong as his voice was completely different from the usual." Shadrach Undara Manrira of Nairobi, Kenya also writes, "Dear Daybreak Africa crew, as a fan of Daybreak Africa program and VOA, my heart is broken to learn of the death of the sports reporter Monk Ouma, who hails from Homambe, a neighboring district to my home district, Kisii. I sincerely send my condolences and respects to all the family members and colleagues at the Voice of America. May you get enough glory to overcome your sorrow. We thank you, our listeners, for your condolences for this sudden death of our sports reporter, Monk Ouma." Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, July 13th.
This is Baba Adama reporter from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. Human and material resources are wasted daily worldwide in the name of fighting against terrorism, yet no positive results. Terrorist attack is increasing on daily basis. Only achievement is in the fight is the transition from fighting against Al-Qaeda and Taliban to the fighting against ISIS and Al-Shabaab. It is high time that the world should go straight to the point. The creation of independent Palestinian state, in addition, the Jewish state, should be stopped from erecting any new site in the controversial Palestinian area. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. United Nations humanitarian workers report finding severe acute malnutrition and famine-like conditions in Nigeria's Borno state, where Boko Haram terrorists are making it even harder to grow and sustain crops. The humanitarian agency says the Borno refugee camps are in hard-to-reach areas where fighting makes it difficult to provide aid, relief. And a fragile ceasefire called by rival leaders appeared to hold Tuesday in South Sudan's capital, Juba, after 4 days of artillery and small arms fire that left hundreds dead and displaced thousands of others. That is it for this Wednesday, July 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor, as well as our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Bate in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. In the afterglow of America's Independence Day celebrations, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss what independence has meant and means for Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.